Chances are you or someone you know are among the tens of millions of people in this country who are taking an anxiolytic, a psychoactive anti-anxiety medication. I'm going to have to take one right now. Today on Please Explain, we're going to talk about our general state of high anxiety and the use and sometimes overuse of Xanax and other benzodiazepines with Lisa Miller, whose article, Listening to Xanax, How America Learned to Stop Worrying About Worrying and Pop Its Pills Instead, is the cover story in this week's New York Magazine. And Dr. Douglas Menon, a psychologist and principal investigator with the Regulation of Emotion and Anxiety and Depression Lab at Hunter College. And we also invited listener calls at 212-433-9692, or you can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. Lisa, in your article for New York Magazine, you mentioned that John Keats described anxiety as a wakeful anguish. Is that how most people who experience anxiety would describe it?
Well, Doug will have to jump in here, but I think, you know, anxiety is a spectrum, and there's worrying. There's a lot of worrying. There's worrying that keeps you up at night and worrying that makes you sweat and obsessive worrying, you know, that I'm going along the spectrum to the... And then there's the woman I talked to who couldn't go to the grocery store without not in the company of her kids for 25 years. So it's a big spectrum, and some people do very well who are anxious, and some people can't get out of the house.
It sounds like some of those people are experiencing psychic pains.
Absolutely, absolutely. There's variability in how much people experience that kind of anxiety, how they express it, but there are some commonalities, and we know that people who experience this kind of fear feel overwhelmed by it and feel that when they experience it, their world changes, their sense of their world changes.
But it's one thing to experience anxiety. It's another thing to have OCD. Are they all related to each other? Are they all part of a spectrum?
There is a spectrum of severity. I mean, one way we determine whether something is a disorder is by how impairing it is and how distressing it is. So some conditions come with more impairment, how much they affect our work, our relationships, how much our internal minds are besieged. And so we have a sense of that, that those that are more severe are more impactful. But absolutely, some of our conditions are more about being afraid of certain situations, whereas others and may occur just once in a while, and others occur throughout much of our lives and characterize much of our day.
Is there something similar happening biochemically?
Yes. Well, with all of the conditions, whether they may be these short term fear of a certain situation or an animal, or some of these longer problems, we really look at the important distinctions here being where is the threat. Is, you know, all of these disorders share a threat component, a sense of perception of threat. And some of those threats are immediate. They're about immediate fear, things like being afraid of dogs or planes or bridges. And some are about more of a distant threat, and some are about an uncertain threat.
Is depression related to anxiety?
Absolutely. I mean, we know that anxiety and depression have shared common pathways. We know our genetic inheritance of anxiety and depression are often shared, but the way they express themselves can be different. Anxiety is typically about threat, future threat, depression often about loss. And so the way we treat some of those problems makes a difference. We know that when people get anxious, they often avoid and withdraw reinforcing situations and as a result become more depressed.
Now, Lisa, you've put the drug Xanax in the title of your article. Is it the one that's most prescribed these days?
Absolutely. It's the most prescribed psychopharmaceutical drug in its generic form in the country, 46 million prescriptions a year. It outsells Zoloft. It outsells Ambien. The only kinds of drugs that do better are hypertension and you know, stress, diabetes-type drugs.
It's also called Alprazolam.
Alprazolam.
I'll never be a pharmacist. So this is just one of the forms of benzodiazepines?
Right. So Xanax is the most popular, but there are a bunch of others as well. And Valium is one, and Ativan, and Klonopin. And remember Halcyon, in about 20 years ago, people were taking it to get on the plane and not remembering where they landed and not remembering where they left their rental car. There's a bunch of different kinds of benzodiazepines. They all do essentially the same thing. They differ in terms of their duration and the intensity of their effect.
Were the early anti-anxiety drugs like Miltown also benzodiazepines?
It was not a benzodiazepine. But one of the things I loved about the Miltown research that I did was the difference in our culture about how we regarded drugs then and how we regard them now. In the 50s, when Miltown was the big anti-anxiety drug, people were proud to take it. They boasted that they were taking it on television. Bob Hope called it the I don't care pill, and Milton Berle was... His wife had to tell him to stop talking about Miltown on TV because he was promoting it so heavily.
But that was in a different family of drugs. Why have we left those and moved on to benzodiazepines?
I mean, they tend to be shorter acting. They don't impair us as much cognitively. They can be used without as much of a physical impact. And so they're then preferred.
Is there some reason that Xanax is preferred to others? Is it just that that's the one the doctors have latched on to, or is it a better drug?
You know, well, I guess a medical professional who prescribes them could speak to why those get prescribed over others. There are a number of them. Xanax is one, but it's common for other ones such as Klonopin and Ativan to also be prescribed.
And they all go ahead.
What Xanax has to offer over the other drugs, and I am not a doctor, is that it has a very short half-life. So it leaves your system really fast, and so it was designed to be spot treatment for panic. And so if you're a person who's afraid of flying, you know it works fast. It leaves your body fast. You can rent your car at the airport and drive safely. The problem is that because it leaves your body so fast, if you're taking it a lot, you go through really serious withdrawal, and you want it more. So its best quality is also its most dangerous quality.
The alternative is something that's longer lasting, and you'll have withdrawal problems for that for different reasons.
Well, I think that, you know, it tapers off more easily. Klonopin tapers off more easily. Valium tapers off more easily.
Well, how do they work? It has an effect on what's called GABA, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. It's about... decreasing some of the communication between neurons and allowing for a calming of the nervous system. We see sedation effects. We see a general overall calming from taking this medication. But there are effects as well, that it's not a magic bullet. And so we see often can see some memory lapses, some other impairments, particularly in certain groups. So groups like the elderly, there are more negative effects where some of those impairments may be more problematic.
Well, it works both ways, isn't it? Also, aren't the benzodiazepines also used as a way of dealing with amnesia? It can cause memory lapses at the same time, help people with amnesia, because I guess it relaxes their anxieties, allows them to remember things. And it's not used just for anxieties. Also insomnia, agitation, seizures, muscle spasms, alcohol withdrawal, pre-medication for medical and even dental procedures.
That's correct.
We're using these things everywhere.
There, to some amount as well. And again, mediated by the same ability to calm the system.
Let's take a call. Our number here is 212-433-9692. Regina, hi, you're on the air. Regina? Or Regina from Corona, are you there?
Hello?
Yes.
No, it's Pat.
Okay. Well, I have written right here, Regina. Go ahead, Pat.
I'm currently on lorazepam, which is the generic for Ativan. And I have been on it for quite some time and can't seem to do without it, but I know I really should be weaned off of it. And I was wondering if they had any suggestions how to wean myself off of this, because someone told me if I just do it myself, I'll have a seizure. I was wondering if that was true.
Anybody have an answer? Well, neither of you are doctors, so mm-hmm. You can't really... talk about those sorts of things, can you?
Yeah, no, I can't offer medical advice on discontinuation, but I think working with a medical professional is important. There are good behavioral programs as well for discontinuing benzodiazepine usage, and working with professionals to do that is important. Part of why there are withdrawal symptoms is that people withdraw from them very rapidly. And so we know that there's careful withdrawal, that can be helpful. So I would suggest working with a medical professional to wean off, particularly with a behavioral professional as well.
Now, Lisa, I was struck by how inexpensive some of these anti-anxiety medications are compared to most other medications.
Incredible. I got this email from a friend who occasionally takes Xanax to fly, and she said she spent $2.53 for 30 tablets.
Wow.
And then her email said that's cheaper than anything in this drugstore besides gum or Blistex, right? So,
but you have to have it prescribed still.
Yes. These are controlled substances. You need a prescription from a doctor. You can't just go get it like shaving cream. But I think that this is part of the big cultural moment, which is that, you know, people are really busy. They're working really hard. You know, therapy, long-term drugs, these don't appeal when you are just slammed with stuff to do all the time. And when you can get quick relief for $2.53, yeah, it's very hard to be more disciplined.
And you describe a kind of pharmacological friendliness between people, giving someone a couple of pills as a way of caring. Since
well,
these are prescription drugs,
like,
can't that be a little dangerous?
Yes, of course it's dangerous, you know. I mean, sharing is the gateway to drug abuse. That's well known. On the other hand, you know, when you have a friend who's having a hard time, you would pour him a scotch or pour him a glass of wine. And it's the same, you know, it's the same tone. That's, you know, oh, you poor thing. Well, I have this thing in my purse. Let me give it to you. It'll make you feel better.
It used to be a Valium. That's also
same thing.
Benzodiazepine?
Yes.
Now, why has Xanax replaced Valium? It actually started with Librium, didn't it? Was that the first benzodiazepine?
Yes, Librium and then Valium. And Xanax is a drug that came in the 80s, in the early 80s. Valium had a very, very long half-life. It could linger in your system for 100 hours. So even though its effects weren't felt for that long, it was still there. And so people who were taking a lot of it had this feeling of being zombies, you know, very numb, kind of unfeeling, depressive. And so, again, Xanax works really fast. It works fast. It leaves your body fast. And that was its huge improvement over Valium, yeah.
Well, benzo, that means benzene, doesn't it? We're taking benzene?
Well... I think what I can speak to is you know the sense of what that does for an individual when someone takes that medication. I think it's important to realize that the medications have a place, but as well the usage of them in the way that Lisa's describing can also be problematic. And being able starting to rely on a medication like this and sort of as a go-to medication can limit one's beliefs about how they can handle situations.
But Lisa's also suggesting that people don't think twice about popping a lot of these pills. So is that part of the problem? You feel the effect going away. You take another one. After a while, you can build up a certain amount of resistance.
Well, that's definitely the problem.
Which is what happens with addiction.
I mean, that's definitely that's the road to addiction for sure. But I think what I thought was so interesting in the research for the story was this idea of a thing called pharmacological Calvinism, which is that we have this ambivalent relationship with the pills. We like them. They're convenient. They're easy. They're cheap. They work fast. And yet we feel like we shouldn't be taking them. And so we joke about it privately and we give them to our friends and we take them once in a while the way we would have a beer or a couple glasses of wine. But we won't go on the record about it. We won't tell our bosses we're taking them. We won't be explicit about it.
Well, it suggests we're weak, doesn't it?
It suggests we're weak. And yet, when you interview people about it, they say, look, I need this stuff. I need it to get on the subway and leave my kid in school. I need it to get on the airplane. I need it when my parent is dying. And all of these reasons seem very real and reasonable. Our anxiety, in a lot of cases, is reasonable. And there are times when a pill can be a reasonable solution, and yet we feel so tortured about it. And I think that's really interesting.
My guests are Lisa Miller, whose article, Listening to Xanax, How America Learned to Stop Worrying About Worrying and Pop Its Pills Instead, is the cover story in this week's New York Magazine. By the way, we have a link to it on our show page at WNYC.org. Also with us is Douglas Menon, psychologist, principal investigator for the Regulation of Emotion and Anxiety and Depression Lab at Hunter College. We're taking your calls at 212-433-9692. You can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. And let's go to a few of those calls. We have Sharon on the line. Hi, Sharon.
Hi. About 3 years ago, my husband was dying, and I was watching this on a daily basis. My doctor gave me some Valium so that I could sleep at night because I wasn't sleeping. And so I would pop 5 milligrams, and then I would pop 10 because the 5 wasn't working. And I got to the point where I was taking 20 a night to fall asleep. And I always thought it was a muscle relaxant. And I did not know it was highly addictive until a friend of mine who's a physician said, don't take this, you'll get addicted. And I stopped it immediately because it scared me.
Did you experience withdrawal?
No. No, not at all. And there were those nights, I'll tell you in all honesty, I think sometimes mind over matter really does work, where even popping 20 did not make me fall asleep quickly or well.
Douglas?
And I still would wake up after 4 hours. It didn't knock me out the way I thought it would. Because I was just so emotionally upset watching my husband die.
But also, I mentioned earlier, you can build a certain amount of resistance to the drug, can't you?
That's true. That's true. And what's called tolerance. You can build up a tolerance. And that happens for some. I think what psychologically, though, when we're taking that pill, we also reinforce that pill is part of how we can cope. So there's ways in acute situations when we first hear of something difficult, when we first have to cope, that, as Lisa mentioned, that the medications can be helpful. And over time, though, when you have a stressful situation and you reach for something like a benzodiazepine and take it, there's a message to our system that that's how we're coping. And an illusory correlation develops that the way that we coped with that situation, the way that we reduced that threat was from taking that medication, taking that benzodiazepine. So over, had we not taken it, it's unclear. How could we have coped with it? So I think it's about the long-term use of medications that are really meant often to be used in the short term.
Let's take another call. Yaakov, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm just... I'm going to have to pull over. I wanted to comment on Xanax in particular, and not so much to disagree with the content of what's been said, but to sort of give more emphasis on its misuse, primarily by primary care physicians. It's a very, very potent medication, in addition to it having a very short half-life. I'm a psychiatrist, and I have a lot of experience working with all of these medications. Xanax is about 2.5 times to 3 times more potent than Ativan and Klonopin, which are 5 times more potent than Valium, which is about 25 times more potent than Librium. So you're getting a very, very strong effect from a medication that doesn't last very long, and it quickly escalates. And detoxing from this medication needs an experienced hand, which many primary care physicians are not inclined or equipped to do. That's really what I wanted to say. These medications are helpful in the right situations. They're a basis of normative psychiatric practice, but Xanax has the potential to be a very, very dangerous medication. If it was really up to me, I'd take it off the market.
One of the things that's changed in America, the way people receive treatment for psychological problems, is that people are relying more on pills, partially because their insurance plans aren't paying for psychotherapy, partially because of the time crunch that I was talking about before. But what I found interesting in my story was that most benzodiazepines are prescribed by general practitioners. So it's not like people are going into mental health treatment and saying, I'm freaking out about this or that, or I'm worried, or I can't sleep. And then the psychiatrist, like our caller, is prescribing the benzo. It's that somebody's going into their family doctor and saying, my husband is dying, or I'm about to get laid off, or, I can't sleep. And it's just sort of a routine part of medical treatment now. And I think that's an area that needs real exploration, because it may be that people like Doug are very good at treating with people with anxiety, but the people with anxiety aren't going to people like Doug.
Also, I think proper assessment's really important, too. I mean, going to either a psychiatric or psychological professional you get a proper assessment of what the problem is. You may be getting treatment that's not appropriate for the problem you have.
Okay, Yaakov, you're at Kingsborough Psychiatric Center. What do you do when someone comes in who's experiencing extreme anxiety?
The first thing is to try to figure out where the anxiety is coming from. You want to rule out all physical causes of anxiety, and there are physical causes of anxiety. You want to make sure that you're addressing a root cause rather than a symptom. As your guests have stated, these medications are short-term medications, and you need to initiate normative treatment almost immediately once you've considered giving them a benzodiazepine. These medications in general hit the same receptors in the brain as alcohol, which is why they're useful in treating withdrawal and detoxing people from alcohol addiction. But they're intoxicants, and as has been mentioned, tolerance develops, and the addiction to these is sometimes harder to treat than the alcohol physically. A comment on what the lady who called in right before me, that she stopped her Valium cold. Well, Valium has a half-life of over 2 weeks, so it's not unusual to not necessarily have withdrawal symptoms from stopping Valium cold, but if you stop Xanax cold, you may experience seizures by the end of the day, depending on your dose and how long you've been on it, etc. I had a patient once who was a veteran. He stopped his Xanax was stopped by a surgeon for surgery, and within 3 hours, he saw the entire Japanese army coming over the hill.
Thank you for calling us.
Sure. My pleasure.
Erica from Manhattan, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you doing? You know, I feel there's a lot of judgmental comments coming from you, Leonard, and from the audience. I'm a Burn Institute person who went for anxiety and cognitive therapy down in Philadelphia, and I take Ativan when I need it, as prescribed.
Now, Erica, I have to interrupt you for a second, because okay. Every so often I hear from listeners that they felt I was judgmental because I was asking questions. That's
okay,
my job, Erica. My job is to ask questions. My job isn't to just simply say, uh-huh. And if that sounds like I'm being judgmental, I'm sorry, but the alternative is for me really to not do what I'm supposed to do in a conversation like this.
But it had a twinge when I was hearing it that everybody who takes an Ativan or a Xanax
I have
is
no
going
such
to become
feeling.
A drug addict.
I have no such feeling. I haven't ever much thought about it. I don't take these drugs because, to be honest, luckily, I don't have too many problems with anxiety. But I think if somebody is anxious and this is the way that they get through, then... Well, that's fine.
Erica, I would like to talk to this because I tried really, really hard in this story to just be real. Just be real about what people were doing, be real about what it's like to live in New York now, be real about what modern life is like and how stressful it is and how anxious, anxiety-producing it can be. And the people who disliked the story the most are people who had really, really terrible experiences, especially with Xanax.
Right.
And so if you look at the comments on the story, it's like, you know, Lisa Miller is a stupid idiot and she doesn't understand how terrible these drugs can be and she's, you know, minimizing. And, you know, like you, I just think this is real life. And, you know, people are coping the best they can. And as a lot of people said to me, you know, people trend toward health. They don't trend toward self-destructive, terrible behavior. So that was my effort in this story, and to get away from all of that sort of puritanical Calvinistic conversation about drugs, because it's just not helpful.
We have to take a little break. When we come back, we will talk about what some of the alternatives might be, and despite Erica's concerns, we will talk about some of the negative things that have been suggested about these drugs, like why some people feel pregnant women shouldn't take them, why some people feel that the elderly shouldn't take them. My guests are Dr. Douglas Menon and Lisa Miller. Her article, Listening to Xanax, How America Learned to Stop Worrying About Worrying and Pop Its Pills Instead, is the cover story in this week's New York Magazine. Our number, 212-433-9692. You can leave a comment on our show page at wnyc.org. We are back with today's Please Explain look at benzodiazepines, especially Xanax, because it's the most popular one. Our guests are Dr. Douglas Menon, a psychologist principal investigator with the Regulation of Emotion and Anxiety and Depression Lab at Hunter College, and with Lisa Miller, whose article, Listening to Xanax, How America Learned to Stop Worrying About Worrying and Pop Its Pills Instead, is the cover story of this week's New York Magazine. We also have a link to it on our show page. And we have a lot of people writing in, and I want to read a few of those comments. Larry in Williamsburg said, it should be discussed more clearly that benzodiazepines work the same way as alcohol. Drinking a glass of wine to relax is the same as taking a benzodiazepine as far as the brain is concerned. As a society, we're okay if it comes in a glass, but not if it comes in a pill. Do you agree, Douglas?
I mean, I think it's a lot what we do with it. I think it's what we do with it. We know that these medications help produce a short-term relief, but what we want really is a long-term change in our lives. So if we're able to use them to help us move towards change and create new experiences in our life, that's going to be more reinforcing. So when we are able to learn how to create change, how to engage new things in our life, then we are often changing the ways we respond to situations, and we have less anxiety. If the medication helps us first initially do that, then it can be helpful. If we engage it every time and don't make changes in our lives, then it may not be producing the effect we really want.
But I do think the comparison with alcohol is interesting, because we all use alcohol and we don't have any negative or moral judgment feelings about it.
Moral judgments about alcoholics, and isn't that what we're talking about here? Using these drugs in moderation,
I am so not saying, you know, that people should be taking a lot of Xanax, or that, you know, people should be having three scotches at night. It's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying in the story is that these are really anxious times, that a lot of people are turning to Xanax and other drugs like it for their anxiety. And it's possible that some of that anxiety and some of that turning to pills is a reasonable thing to do.
Is that happening more in this country and in the big cities like New York?
It's happening all over the country. I mean, 46 million prescriptions is a lot of prescriptions.
Are we seeing it prescribed in England and France and
Definitely.
Cambodia?
And it's also prescribed in poorer and rural areas for the treatment of alcohol addiction. A federal alcohol and drug abuse official told me that the person likeliest to abuse Xanax in America is not Heath Ledger or Whitney Houston or Michael Jackson, but a 18 to 34-year-old white man who was unemployed and also addicted to something else, heroin, painkiller or alcohol.
Does it work as something that can get you off another addiction?
It has been used that way, yes, and it can be helpful.
I remember heroin was originally used to get people off of other addictions. People didn't realize that it was probably the most addictive of them all.
When people die with Xanax in their system, they often have at least two other things in their system as well.
Let's go to another caller, another doctor, in fact, Dr. Steve Weisblatt. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Okay.
A couple things. Lisa spoke to it earlier, the issue of anxiety. Anxiety is used by the brain as a signal. So if a police cruiser pulls us over, we should be anxious and pull over. If we go to a stoplight, we should be anxious to stop. So anxiety really is a service to the brain when it's not amplified. And I think when we talk about people taking medication to alleviate a symptom, we're talking about someone who has amplified anxiety. As the psychologist on the program noted, sometimes anxiety can be part of a specific fear of something, and sometimes it's generalized. If it's generalized, then it should be seen as a symptom rather than a syndrome. In other words, if we have an elevated body temperature and we go to the hospital, we try to figure out, is that a urinary tract infection? Is that pneumonia? Is that some other medical disease causing an amplified temperature? In the same way, we don't want to treat symptoms. Unfortunately, it's so available that all too readily we medicate it away rather than seeing amplified that anxiety as, for example, a symptom of sometimes bipolar spectrum disorder, which is a low-grade form of bipolar disorder. Even the main form of bipolar disorder that's very extreme is misdiagnosed in this country 68% of the time. You can only imagine how much the smaller and more subtle forms are misdiagnosed. And tragically, because of the ubiquitous availability and, unfortunately, easy comfort among physicians to prescribe medications to treat a symptom, often we're covering up syndromes. And that's very unfortunate.
Thank you for your call. Douglas, in your case, you're a psychologist, not a psychiatrist, so you don't prescribe medications. When a patient comes to you suffering from heavy anxiety, serious anxiety, how do you approach it?
You know, there are many ways to approach anxiety. And as I was mentioning before, one of the ways we work with individuals is to encourage them to, as the caller noted, to be in the presence of their anxiety. And anxiety is a signal, and we receive anxiety often when things are important to us. And so in the modern world, we're less having to deal with tigers running after us. We're more faced with threats that are uncertain in the future, but are often attached to things that we want, rewards we want, things that we value. And so, you know, as the caller noted, there may be importance in being able to have more flexibility and have more ability to cope with that anxiety. So we do that in a number of different ways. People have a natural ability to gain perspective and take perspective on their situation. And if the emotion isn't as intense, they have a natural ability to actually reappraise. And we see an area of the brain, the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, activate and diminish activity in other areas that are involved in generative features of anxiety like the amygdala. However, some individuals, when they have more intense anxiety and are more perseverative, they worry, they ruminate, they're already processing verbally a lot. And so they may not be as responsive to being able to verbal abilities or verbal ways of coping. And even psychotherapy in itself is largely a verbal practice. And so be able to work with people to learn other ways to manage and cope their anxiety without all that elaboration has been helpful. In fact, some of the problems may be all the ways they're trying to control anxiety. So again, if that medication is being used as a method to control, that may be problematic and may sell that person short.
Laura from New Jersey, you're on the air.
Yes. Hey, Leonard. Thanks for taking my call. I love your show. I had a really serious withdrawal from Xanax after only using it daily for about 3 weeks, 10 milligram dose. And I became so sick from withdrawal that I was actually hospitalized for 2 days under a doctor's care because I was on the verge of seizures and physical problems as a result of the withdrawal, and I became almost suicidal over it. It was the worst experience of my entire life, and I would never recommend anyone to take it, and I would never take it again under any circumstances.
But can we say that this is a special situation? Not everybody has that kind of terrible reaction.
No, I think that's true. But it is the thing that you hear about Xanax, which is that, you know, you take a lot of it, your doses are high, and the withdrawal is really terrible.
Well, I mentioned earlier that there are some other things that people are concerned about. Women are told, pregnant women are told not to take it. Isn't there some thinking that it might lead to cleft palates?
It's a controversial finding, and there are many who would disagree with that. I'd say that that's an inconclusive finding.
But are there other reasons pregnant women are told not to take it?
You know,
I've heard of withdrawal problems in newborns. You haven't heard about that, Lisa?
I haven't. I think these are controlled substances. They're prescribed by doctors. Doctors need to look at the individual patient and figure out what he or she needs at that time. And I think the broader issue of abuse and addiction and withdrawal is a serious one. And the prevalence of general practitioners giving out anti-anxiety medicine to people who are freaking out for daily events is the sort of bigger cultural issue that we need to talk about.
John in New York asks, can you talk about the rebound effect of benzos when the anxiety returns even more severely after the medication wears off. Sometimes, even when one is still on them.
I think that speaks to, you know, the importance of learning other things to manage your anxiety. We know that there's a very good therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy, that helps people reduce taking benzodiazepines such as Xanax. And from that is learning skills to cope with your anxiety, learning ways to breathe and relax, also to accept and reduce the need to control anxiety, help us, especially when we're in discontinuation, we're going to experience more physiological symptoms. And so being able to cope and learn how to respond when we have those physical symptoms in our body is going to be important and more long-lasting.
Other people have asked about whether beta blockers are a reasonable alternative or muscle relaxants.
Yeah, I mean, people take all kinds of stuff for their anxiety. As another caller said, people take beer for their anxiety. People take smoke pot for their anxiety. People shop
We've gotten that call, too.
People shop and gamble and, you know, look at porn for their anxiety. You know, I think a larger issue here is what is the healthy amount of anxiety and what can we live with? And what makes, I mean, for me, anxiety sort of helps me through my day. I don't want to get rid of my anxiety. I want to live with it. And I want to live with it in a way that absolutely, that's calibrated to the point where it's making me achieve everything I can achieve and be as on as I can be and then not, you know, paralyzing me or keeping me up at night. Sometimes a pill is the answer.
Let's take another call. Rich from Westbury, you're on the air.
Now, I was wondering about the actual uses of prescribing benzos for opiate withdrawals, specifically the psychological effects, and whether it's actually useful.
There was a story.
Is breaking up,
right.
But we got the gist of it.
There was a story in the New York Times in the fall about a clinic, a rehab clinic in Kentucky, I think it was, that decided because so many of the patients in the clinic were becoming addicted to Xanax and it, as part of their treatment, that they were going to stop prescribing Xanax completely. And it was wildly controversial. And on the message boards, it was just on fire because people were saying, you know, you can't take the pills away from the people who are on them because they're addicted to something else. It's nuts. And then other people were saying, as the psychiatrist did earlier, you know, I would stop prescribing it. I would make it illegal. So.
Now, okay, let's say I'm we have very little time here,
yeah.
But let's say I experience an incredible amount of anxiety. What would be the next step? If I go to a psychologist, I'm going to hear one answer. If I go to a pharmacologist, I'm going to get another answer. And if I go to my GP, I may get a third answer.
Not necessarily. I think that you can have integrated care. There are organizations like the Anxiety Disorders Association of America where psychiatrists and psychologists work together and work towards disseminating to the public the need for a number of different types of treatment alternatives. I think there's a place for different medications. We haven't talked that much about antidepressants, but there's also a place for antidepressants.
Antidepressants are a whole other family?
Another family of medications, yeah, that are also used for anxiety as well and can be helpful particularly in severe forms, and that's been in the news lately too. But particularly when there's severe forms of depression, that may be helpful.
And
but
then there's Luvox that is used to treat OCD. That's not a benzodiazepine either?
No, it's not. It's a special form of that affects serotonin.
A number of listeners have wondered, are we just experiencing more stressful times?
Right. It's a very, very good question. And it's where we started in writing this article. It's hard to know. You know, is it more stressful now than it was during the Cold War when we knew that nuclear bombs were pointed right at us and could be sent off any minute? I'm not sure. It's definitely true that our anxiety, the sources of our anxiety are everywhere and inchoate. We don't know where they're coming from and when they will come.
We have a link to Lisa Miller's article for the current issue of New York Magazine, Listening to Xanax, How America Learned to Stop Worrying About Worrying and Pop Its Pills Instead. Thank you both so much for being on our show.
Thanks.
Thank you.
On Monday's show, Frontline correspondent Lowell Bergman talks about his new report on Rupert Murdoch's troubled media dynasty. And then Michael Tilson Thomas, the director of the San Francisco Symphony, discusses the citywide celebration American Mavericks and his upcoming performances at Carnegie Hall. A History of the World of 100 Objects takes a look at 12 figures buried in the tomb of a Tang-era Chinese general. Plus, we will discuss the controversy surrounding the plans to expand NYU. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Stephen Valentino, Julia Corcoran, Melissa Egan's the executive producer. I'm with help today from Judy Cho, Christy Goldotti, and contributing producer Bonnie LaFave. Debbie Fountain was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening, and we will see you next week.